all became more intense, and at the same time the wind veered to the southeast. It was a setback. In order to stick to his route, Mr. Fogg had to take in the sails and increase the steam. Nevertheless, the ship's progress was slowed down by the state of the sea, with high waves breaking against its stem. The ship began to pitch violently, and this further affected its speed. The wind was gradually reaching hurricane force, and it already looked as if the Henrietta might not be able to face the waves full on. But if it had to run before the storm, that would be a leap into the unknown, with all the dangers that this entailed. Passepartout's face became as dark as the sky, and for 2 days the worthy fellow was on tenterhooks. But Phileas Fogg was a bold sailor who knew how to stand up to the sea, and he kept straight on without even reducing steam. When the Henrietta couldn't rise above the waves, it went straight through them, and although the deck was swamped, the ship carried on. Sometimes, too, the propeller was lifted clean out of the water, and the blades whirred madly in the air as a mountainous wave raised the stern. But still the ship continued on its course. Nevertheless, the wind didn't freshen as much as might have been feared. It wasn't one of those hurricanes that reach speeds of up to 90 miles per hour. The wind didn't go beyond gale force, but unfortunately it kept on blowing from the southeast and made it impossible to put the sails out. However, as will soon become apparent, the wind would have been very useful for helping out the steam power. The 16th of December was the 75th day since they had left London. In a word, the delay to the Henrietta was still not serious. Half the crossing had almost been completed, and the most difficult waters were already behind them. If it had been summer, success would have been guaranteed. As it was winter, they were at the mercy of bad weather. Passepartout didn't make his views known. Deep down he was hopeful, and if the wind failed, he was counting on steam to get them there. As it happened, on that particular day, the engineer went on deck, met Mr. Fogg, and had quite a sharp conversation with him. Without knowing why, no doubt by a premonition, Passepartout felt a vague sort of uneasiness. He would have given his right arm to hear what was being said. However, he did manage to catch a few words, including the following, spoken by his master. "Are you sure that what you're saying is true?"
"Absolutely certain, sir," replied the engineer.
"Don't forget that since we set out we've been going full blast, and even if we had enough coal to go at low steam from New York to Bordeaux, we don't have enough to go at full steam from New York to Liverpool."
"I shall decide what to do," replied Mr. Fogg.
Passepartout had understood. He suddenly became extremely worried. They were going to run out of coal.
"Oh, if my master can get us out of this one," he said to himself, "then he really is somebody."
After bumping into Fix, he couldn't help telling him about the situation.
"So," the inspector replied, gritting his teeth, "you really think that we're heading for Liverpool?"
"But of course."
"Idiot,"
answered the inspector as he walked away, shrugging his shoulders. Passepartout was about to take strong exception to this word, even if he wasn't in a position to understand its full significance. But he said to himself that poor old Fix must be very disappointed, and that his pride must have taken a battering at the idea of having gone around the world on a wild goose chase. And so Passepartout let the remark pass. So what would Phileas Fogg's decision be? It was hard to imagine. However, the phlegmatic gentleman seemed to have made up his mind, because that very evening he sent for the engineer and said to him, "Stoke up the boilers and go full steam ahead until there's no fuel left." A few moments later, the Henrietta's funnel was belching out clouds of smoke. So the ship continued on course at full steam. But just as he had warned, 2 days later, the 18th, the engineer announced that they would run out of coal during that day.
"Don't let the fires die down," replied Mr. Fogg. "On the contrary, keep up the pressure in the engine."
That day, at about midday, after taking a bearing to calculate the ship's position, Phileas Fogg sent for Passepartout and told him to go and fetch Captain Speedy. It was like telling the good fellow to go and unleash a tiger, and he went down to the poop deck, saying to himself,
"He's going to go absolutely berserk."
A few minutes later, amid shouting and swearing, a bomb duly landed on the poop deck. This bomb was Captain Speedy,
It was obvious that he was about to explode.
"Where are we?"
were the first words he uttered, choking with anger, and it was clear that if this worthy fellow had had a weak heart, he would never have survived.
"Where are we?"
he repeated, red in the face.
770 miles east of Liverpool, replied Mr. Fogg, with total composure.
"Pirate!"
exclaimed Andrew Speedy.
"I sent for you, sir."
"Sea rover!"
"Sir," continued Mr. Fogg, "to ask you to sell me your ship."
"No, like hell, no!"
"The fact is that I'm going to have to burn it."
"Burn my ship?"
"Yes, at least the upper works, because we're running out of fuel."
"Burn my ship!"
exclaimed Captain Speedy, who had difficulty getting the words out of his mouth any more.
"A ship worth $50,000?
"Here's $60,000, replied Phileas Fogg, handing the captain a wad of banknotes. The effect on Andrew Speedy was spectacular. No true American can fail to be moved by the sight of $60,000. For a moment the captain forgot about his anger, his imprisonment, and all his grievances against his passenger. His ship was 20 years old. This deal was worth a packet. The bomb was no longer going to explode. Mr. Fogg had removed the fuse.
"But I'll still have the iron hull left," he said, sounding remarkably calmer.
"The iron hull and the machinery, sir. Are we agreed?"
"Agreed."
With that, Andrew Speedy grabbed the wad of banknotes, counted them, and stashed them away in his pocket. During this scene, Passepartout was white as a sheet. Fix, for his part, almost had a heart attack. Nearly £20,000 had already been spent, and now here was Fogg giving away to the vendor the hull and the machinery, in other words, almost half the total value of the ship. It was just as well that the amount of money stolen from the bank was £55,000. When Andrew Speedy had put all the money away in his pocket, Mr. Fogg said to him, "Sir, let me explain something to you. If I am not back in London by 8:45 in the evening on the 21st of December, I will lose £20,000. The fact is that I missed the steamer from New York, and because you refused to take me to Liverpool..."
"And I did the right thing there. I'll swear that by the devil," exclaimed Andrew Speedy, "because I've made at least $40,000.
Then he added rather more calmly,
"Do you know something, Captain
Fogg?"
"Captain Fogg? Well, there's a bit of the Yankee about you."
And after giving his passenger what he thought was a compliment, he was about to go when Phileas Fogg said to him,
"So this boat belongs to me now, doesn't it?"
"Well, from the keel to the top of the masts, everything made of wood, that is."
"Good. Take out all the internal fittings and use them as firewood."
It is easy to imagine how much dry wood needs to be burned to keep the steam up to sufficient pressure. That day the poop deck, the deck houses, the cabins, the crew's quarters, and the spar deck all went. The following day, the 19th of December, they burnt the masting, the spare masts and yards, and the spars. They chopped down the masts and cut them up with axes. The crew set about their task with incredible energy. Passepartout was slicing, cutting, and sawing away, doing the work of 10 men. It was an orgy of destruction. The day after, the 20th of December, the rails, the bulwarks, the deadworks, and most of the deck were fed to the flames. The Henrietta was now so low it looked like a pontoon, not a ship. But that day they sighted the coast of Ireland and the Fastnet lighthouse. However, by 10 o'clock in the evening, the ship was still off Queenstown. Phileas Fogg only had 24 hours left to get to London. That was precisely how long it would take the Henrietta to get to Liverpool, even if it went at full steam. And steam was just what the daring gentleman was running out of.
"Sir,"
Captain Speedy then said to him, as he had now come round to showing an interest in his plans,
"I feel really sorry for you. Everything's against you. We're still no further than Queenstown."
"Ah," said Mr. Fogg, "is that the town we can see, where the lights are coming from?"
"Yes."
"Can we enter the harbour?"
Not for another 3 hours, only at high tide.
Let's wait, then, Phileas Fogg replied calmly, without letting it show on his face that he was about to attempt once again to overcome his bad luck by another masterstroke. Queenstown is, as it happens, a port on the Irish coast where transatlantic liners from the United States drop off their mailbags. These letters are taken to Dublin by express trains that are always ready and waiting. From Dublin, they go to Liverpool via high-speed steamers, cutting 12 hours off the time taken by the fastest vessels of the shipping companies. Phileas Fogg thought that he, too, could make up 12 hours, as the mail from America did. Instead of arriving in Liverpool on the Henrietta the following evening, he would get there by midday, which would allow him time to get to London by 8:45 in the evening. Towards 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the Henrietta entered Queenstown Harbour on the full tide, and Phileas Fogg, after receiving a vigorous handshake from Captain Speedy, left the latter on the flattened carcass of his ship, which was still worth half what he had got for selling it. The passengers disembarked immediately. Fix, at that moment, felt a great urge to arrest Fogg. He refrained from doing so, however. Why? What struggle was going on inside him? Had he changed his mind about Mr. Fogg? Did he realize at last that he'd been wrong? Nevertheless, Fix did not let go of Mr. Fogg. Along with him, Mrs. Ayuda and Passepartout, who was in such a rush he didn't pause for breath, he got into the train from Queenstown at 1:30 in the morning, reached Dublin as dawn was breaking, and immediately got onto one of those steamers, real steel rockets that are all engine, which do not bother to rise with the waves but invariably go straight through them. At 20 minutes to midday on the 21st of December, Phileas Fogg at last landed at Liverpool docks. He was only 6 hours away from London. But at that moment Fix went up to him, put his hand on his shoulder, and, showing him his warrant, said,
"You are Phileas Fogg, are you not?"
"Yes, sir."
"In the name of Her Majesty the Queen, I arrest you."
Chapter 34, which provides Passepartout with the opportunity to make an appalling but perhaps original play on words. Phileas Fogg was in prison. He had been locked up in the jail of the Custom House in Liverpool and was to spend the night there before being transferred to London. At the time of the arrest, Passepartout's instinct was to throw himself at the detective. He had been restrained by some policemen. Mrs. Ayuda was horrified at the brutality of it all and, because she knew nothing about the background, was unable to understand what was happening. Passepartout explained the situation to her. Mr. Fogg, this upright and courageous gentleman to whom she owed her life, had been arrested like a common thief. The young woman protested against this allegation. She felt deep indignation, and tears poured down her cheeks when she saw she was powerless to do anything, to attempt anything, to save her savior. As for Fix, he had arrested the gentleman because his sense of duty told him to do so, irrespective of whether or not he was guilty. The courts would decide that. But then something occurred to Passepartout, the terrible thought that he was the cause of this whole disaster. Why on earth had he concealed the situation from Mr. Fogg? When Fix had revealed that he was a police inspector and that his task was to arrest Mr. Fogg, why had he taken it upon himself not to alert his master? If he had warned him, his master would certainly have given Fix proof of his innocence and would have shown him his error. In any case, he wouldn't have dragged the wretched detective behind him all around the world and at his own expense when the man's main concern was to arrest him the moment he set foot on British soil. When he thought about all his foolishness and carelessness, the poor fellow was overcome with remorse. He cried. He was a pathetic sight. He wanted to knock himself senseless. Despite the cold, Mrs. Ayuda and he had stayed under the portico of the Custom House. Neither of them wanted to leave the place. They wanted to see Mr. Fogg just one more time. As for the gentleman himself, he was well and truly ruined, financially speaking, and just as he was reaching his goal. His arrest meant the end of everything for him. When he had arrived in Liverpool at 20 minutes to midday on the 21st of December, he had until 8:45 to show up at the Reform Club, In other words, 9 hours and 15 minutes, and he only needed 6 to get to London. Anyone going into the custom house at that moment would have found Mr. Fogg sitting motionless on a wooden bench, showing no signs of anger and looking as imperturbable as ever. It was impossible to tell whether he was resigned, but this last blow didn't seem to have affected him, at least outwardly. Was there, burning away inside him, some secret rage, frightening because it was bottled up until the last moment when it would burst out with unstoppable force? No one could tell. But Phileas Fogg was sitting there, calm, waiting. But for what? Did he still retain some hope? Did he still believe he could succeed after the prison door had closed behind him? Whatever the case, Mr. Fogg had carefully placed his watch on the table, and he was looking at the hands move forward. Not a word crossed his lips, but there was an especially intent look on his face. In any event, the situation was grim, and for anyone unable to read what was going through his mind, it may be summed up as follows. If he was an honest man, Phileas Fogg was ruined. If he was a criminal, he had been caught. Did it occur to him at this point to try to escape? Did he think of looking for a possible way out of where he was being held? Did he plan to run away? It might be tempting to think so, because at one point he walked around the room. But the door was firmly locked, and the windows were equipped with iron bars. So he went to sit down again and took out his pocketbook, his travel schedule. On the line where he had written, 21st of December, Saturday, Liverpool, he added, 80th day, 11:40 a.m. Then he waited. 1 o'clock struck on the custom house clock. Mr. Fogg noted that his watch was 2 minutes ahead of this clock. 2 o'clock. Assuming that he got onto an express train there and then, he could still get to London and to the Reform Club before 8:45 in the evening. He frowned slightly. At 2:33, there was a commotion outside, the noise of doors being flung open. Passepartout's voice could be heard, and Fix's. Phileas Fogg's face lit up for a moment. The cell door opened, and he saw Mrs. Ayuda, Passepartout, and Fix rushing towards him. Fix was out of breath and his hair all over the place. He was unable to speak properly.
"Sir," he stammered, "sir, sorry, unfortunate likeness. Thief arrested 3 days ago. You free."
Phileas Fogg was free. He went up to the detective. He looked him straight in the eye and, with the only rapid movement he had ever made or ever would make in his life, he swung his arms back and then, with the precision of an automaton, struck the unfortunate inspector with both fists.
"Well hit!"
exclaimed Passepartout, who allowed himself an appalling play on words worthy of a true Frenchman by adding,
"Good heavens! That's what I call a striking example of the benefits of an English education."
Fix, who had been knocked to the floor, didn't say a word. He'd only got what he deserved. But immediately Mr. Fogg, Mrs. Ayuda and Passepartout left the custom house. They jumped into a cab and within a few minutes were at Liverpool station. Phileas Fogg asked if there was an express ready to leave for London. It was 2:40. The express had left 35 minutes earlier. Phileas Fogg then ordered a special train. There were several high-speed locomotives with steam up, but for operating reasons, the special train was unable to leave the station until 3 o'clock. By 3 o'clock, after having a word with the engine driver about a bonus he could earn, Phileas Fogg was speeding off towards London in the company of the young woman and his faithful servant. They needed to cover the distance between Liverpool and London in 5.5 hours. This was a perfectly reasonable proposition when the line was clear all the way, but there were unavoidable delays. And so by the time the gentleman arrived at the station, all the clocks in London were showing 9:10. After completing his journey around the world, Phileas Fogg had arrived 5 minutes late. He had lost. Chapter 35, in which Passepartout doesn't need to be told twice to do as his master orders. The following day, the inhabitants of Savile Row would certainly have been surprised to be informed that Mr. Fogg was back in residence. The windows and doors were all closed. Nothing had changed from the outside. What had happened was that after leaving the station, Phileas Fogg had told Passepartout to buy some food, and he had gone back to his house. The gentleman had responded to this blow with his usual impassiveness. He was ruined, and it was all the fault of this bungling police inspector. After travelling at a steady pace during this long journey, after overcoming 1,000 obstacles, braving 1,000 dangers, and finding the time to do some good on the way, to fail at his port of arrival in such violent circumstances, which he could not have foreseen and was powerless to combat, was a terrible thing. Of the sizable sum of money he had taken with him when he set out, only an insignificant amount was left over. All that remained of his fortune was the £20,000 deposited with Baring Brothers, and even those £20,000 were what he owed to his colleagues from the Reform Club. After spending so much money, even if he had won his bet, he probably wouldn't have been very much richer. Anyway, that probably hadn't been his aim, since he was the sort of man who bet for honour, not gain. But losing his bet spelt his financial ruin. In any case, the gentleman had made up his mind. He knew what was left for him to do. A room in the house in Savile Row had been set aside for Mrs. Ayuda. The young woman was desperate. From some comments of Mr. Fogg, she had concluded that he was planning some fateful deed. It is, of course, well known to what dreadful extremes English monomaniacs can be driven by their single-minded obsessions. This was why Passepartout was keeping a careful eye on his master, without making it obvious. But before anything else, the good fellow had gone up to his bedroom and switched off the gas lamp, which had been burning away for 80 days. He had found the bill from the gas company in the letterbox, and he thought it was high time he put an end to the costs he had incurred. The night went by. Mr. Fogg had gone to bed, but did he sleep? As for Mrs. Ayuda, she was unable to get any rest at all. Passepartout, for his part, had kept watch outside his master's room like a faithful dog. The next day Mr. Fogg called for him and told him in as few words as possible to see to Mrs. Ayuda's breakfast. All he wanted for himself was a cup of tea and a piece of toast. He would like Mrs. Ayuda to excuse him for lunch and dinner because he needed to devote all his time to putting his affairs in order. He would not be going downstairs. Only in the evening would he ask Mrs. Ayuda's permission to speak to her for a few moments. Having been informed of his master's schedule for the day, all Passepartout could do was to fall in with it. He looked at his master, who was as impassive as ever, and he couldn't find the courage to leave his room. He was downcast and beset with remorse, because he felt more and more responsible for this irreparable disaster. If only he had warned Mr. Fogg and disclosed Fix's plans to him, Mr. Fogg would certainly not have trailed the detective along behind him all the way to Liverpool, and then... Passepartout couldn't stand it any longer.
"Master! Mr. Fogg!" he exclaimed. "Curse me! It's all my fault that..."
"I'm not going to accuse anyone," replied Mr. Fogg in the calmest tone of voice imaginable. "Off you go." Passepartout left the room and went off to see the young woman to tell her what his master's intentions were.
"Madame, I'm absolutely powerless on my own. I have no influence whatsoever over my master. Perhaps you..."
"What influence could I have?" replied Mrs. Ayuda. "Mr. Fogg is impervious to any. Has he ever realized how much I wanted to pour out my gratitude to him? Has he ever been able to read my heart? My friend, you must not leave him alone, not for a single moment. You say that he has expressed the intention of speaking to me this evening?"
"Yes, madame. It must be to do with safeguarding your position in England."
"Let's wait and see," replied the young woman, looking thoughtful. And so for the whole of that Sunday, the house in Savile Row looked deserted, and for the first time since living there, Phileas Fogg did not go to his club as Big Ben struck 11:30. In any case, what would have been the point in the gentleman going to the Reform Club? His colleagues were no longer expecting him. Since, on the previous evening, on the fateful date of Saturday the 21st of December, Phileas Fogg had not shown up in the lounge of the Reform Club by 8:45, he had lost his bet. There was no longer even any need for him to go to his bank to withdraw the sum of £20,000. His opponents already had in their hands a check he had signed, and all that was needed was to put the check through his account with Baring Brothers for the £20,000 to be credited to them. As there was no point in Mr. Fogg going out, so he didn't do so. He stayed in his room and put his affairs in order. Passepartout kept going up and down the staircase in the house in Savile Row. Time went by very slowly for the poor fellow. He listened outside the door of his master's bedroom, and did so without thinking that he was being in the least indiscreet. He looked through the keyhole with the firm conviction that he was entitled to do so. Passepartout feared a catastrophe at any moment. Sometimes he thought about Fix, but a change had come over him. He no longer bore a grudge against the police inspector. Like everybody else, Fix had been wrong about Phileas Fogg, and in trailing him and arresting him, he had only been doing his duty. Whereas he, Passepartout, he was overwhelmed by the thought of this, and he considered himself the most wretched of creatures. When eventually Passepartout felt too unhappy to be alone, he knocked on Mrs. Ayouda's door, went into her bedroom, sat down in a corner without saying anything, and looked at the young woman, who still seemed lost in her thoughts. At about 7:30 in the evening, Mr. Fogg sent a message to Mrs. Ayouda asking to be allowed to see her, and a few moments later the young woman and he were alone together in her room. Phileas Fogg took a chair and sat down near the fireplace, opposite Mrs. Ayouda. His face was expressionless. The Fogg who had come back was exactly the same Fogg as had gone away, the same calm and the same impassiveness. He remained silent for 5 minutes. Then, looking up at Mrs. Ayouda, he said, "Madam, will you forgive me for having brought you to England?"
"Forgive you, Mr. Fogg?" replied Mrs. Ayouda, struggling to keep her emotions under control.
"Please allow me to finish," continued Mr. Fogg. "When I conceived the idea of taking you far away from your own country, which had become so dangerous for you, I was a wealthy man, and I was expecting to bestow some of that wealth upon you. Your life would have been happy and free. Now I am penniless."
"I know, Mr. Fogg," the young woman replied, "and I would like to ask you something in turn. Will you forgive me for having followed you and, who can tell, for perhaps having contributed to your ruin by delaying you?"
"Madam, it was impossible for you to remain in India, and your safety could only be guaranteed by making sure that you were far enough away not to fall into the hands of those fanatics again."
"So, Mr. Fogg," Mrs. Ayouda continued, "not content to rescue me from a horrible death, you also felt duty-bound to provide for me abroad?"
"Yes, madam, but things have turned out against me. However, I ask to be allowed to bestow on you the little I still have."
"But what will become of you, Mr. Fogg?" asked Mrs. Ayouda.
"I, madam," the gentleman replied coldly, "need nothing."
"But how, sir, will you face the fate that awaits you?"
"In the appropriate way," replied Mr. Fogg.
"In any case," went on Mrs. Ayouda, "poverty cannot afflict a person such as you. Your friends..."
"I have no friends, madam."
"Your relatives?"
"I have no relatives left."
"I feel truly sorry for you then, Mr. Fogg, because loneliness is a sad thing. No one to pour your heart out to. And yet people say that even poverty is bearable as long as there are two of you."
"So it is said, madam."
"Mr. Fogg," Mrs. Ayouda then said,
as she got to her feet and offered the gentleman her hand,
"would you like both a relative and a friend? Would you like to have me as your wife?"
When he heard these words, Mr. Fogg also got to his feet. There was a sort of unusual gleam in his eyes, and his lips looked as if they were trembling. Mrs. Ayouda looked at him. The sincerity, uprightness, firmness, and gentleness of the beautiful gaze of a noble woman who will risk anything to save the person to whom she owes everything, first surprised and then penetrated him. He closed his eyes for a moment
as if to prevent this gaze from going any deeper into him. When he opened them, he said simply, "I love you. Yes, truly by everything that is sacred in the world, I love you, and I am wholly yours." "Ah," exclaimed Mrs. Ayuda, placing her hand on her heart. Passepartout was rung for. He came straight away. Mr. Fogg was still holding Mrs. Ayuda's hand in his. Passepartout understood, and his broad face beamed like the midday sun in a tropical sky. Mr. Fogg asked whether it was too late to give notice to the Reverend Samuel Wilson of the parish of Marylebone. Passepartout put on his best smile.
"Never too late," he said.
It was only 8:05.
"It'll be for tomorrow, Monday," he said.
"Tomorrow, Monday?" asked Mr. Fogg, looking at the young woman.
"Tomorrow, Monday," replied Mrs. Ayuda.
Passepartout went out of the house, running as fast as he could. Chapter 36, in which shares in Phileas Fogg are back in demand on the stock market. Now is the time to recount how public opinion suddenly changed when the news broke that the real bank robber, a certain James Strand, had been arrested on the 17th of December in Edinburgh. 3 days earlier, Phileas Fogg had been a criminal ruthlessly hunted down by the police, and now he was the most respectable of gentlemen who, with a mathematical sense of timing, was completing his eccentric journey around the world. It created a huge splash and sensation in the newspapers. The whole betting fraternity, both for and against, which had forgotten all about this business, suddenly reappeared from nowhere. All the earlier transactions were valid again. All the financial commitments were once more binding, and, it must also be said, the betting started up again with renewed vigour. Phileas Fogg's name was once more in demand on the London market. The gentleman's 5 colleagues from the Reform Club spent those 3 days in a state of some anxiety. The Phileas Fogg they had forgotten about was reappearing before their very eyes. Where was he at that particular moment? By the 17th of December, the day when James Strand had been arrested, Phileas Fogg had been away for 76 days, and they hadn't heard a word from him. Had he been killed? Had he given up the struggle? Or was he still continuing his journey following the agreed route? Would he suddenly show up outside the drawing room of the Reform Club on Saturday the 21st of December at 8:45 in the evening, like an incarnation of the god of punctuality? It would be impossible to describe the anxiety that afflicted this section of English society over those 3 days. Telegrams were sent to America and to Asia in an attempt to get news of Phileas Fogg. Someone was sent morning and evening to keep a lookout on the house in Savile Row, to no avail. Even the police had no idea of the whereabouts of Inspector Fix, who had so unfortunately followed the wrong lead. None of this, however, prevented the betting from starting up again, and on an even greater scale. Like a racehorse, Phileas Fogg was now into the final straight. The odds quoted against him were no longer 100-1, but 20, 10, 5, and the elderly invalid Lord Albemarle was putting money on him at evens. On the Saturday evening, there was therefore a large crowd in Pall Mall and the surrounding area. It looked like a huge gathering of stockbrokers permanently stationed outside the Reform Club. No traffic could get through. People were talking and arguing and shouting out the value of Phileas Fogg shares as if they were government bonds. The police had considerable difficulty in controlling the crowds of onlookers, and the nearer it got to the time when Phileas Fogg was supposed to arrive, the more the tension and excitement mounted. That evening, the gentleman's 5 colleagues had been together for 9 hours in the main drawing room of the Reform Club. The 2 bankers, John Sullivan and Samuel Fallentin, the engineer, Andrew Stewart, Gauthier Ralph, one of the directors of the Bank of England, and the brewer, Thomas Flanagan, were all waiting anxiously. At the moment when the clock in the main drawing room showed 8:25, Andrew Stewart got up and said, "Gentlemen, in 20 minutes the deadline agreed between Mr. Fogg and ourselves will have expired."
"What time did the last train from Liverpool arrive?" asked Thomas Flanagan.
7:23, replied Gauthier Ralph.
and the next train doesn't arrive until 10 past midnight.
Well then, gentlemen, continued Andrew Stewart, if Phileas Fogg had arrived on the 7:23, he would have been here by now. We can therefore assume that we've won the bet.
Let's wait before we come to any conclusion, replied Samuel Fallentin. You know that our colleague is an eccentric of the highest order. It's well known how exact he is in everything. He never arrives too early or too late, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if he showed up here at the last minute.
Personally, said Andrew Stewart, extremely tense as usual, if he was standing in front of me, I wouldn't believe my own eyes.
I agree, went on Thomas Flanagan. Phileas Fogg's plan was completely crazy. However exact he may have been, it was impossible for him to prevent unavoidable delays from happening, and a delay of 2 or 3 days was enough to jeopardize his journey.
You will note, in addition, added John Sullivan, that we have received no news at all of our colleague, and yet there were plenty of opportunities for him to send a telegram during his travels.
He has lost, gentlemen, Andrew Stewart replied. He has lost, hands down. You know, in any case, that the China, the only steamer from New York that he could have caught to get to Liverpool in time, arrived yesterday. Well, here's the passenger list as published in the Shipping Gazette, and Phileas Fogg's name is not on it. Even if luck was on his side, our colleague would still hardly have reached America. I would reckon that he's about 20 days at least behind schedule, and that poor old Lord Albemarle will also lose his £5,000.
It's obvious, replied Gauthier Ralph, and tomorrow all we have to do is to present Mr. Fogg's check at Baring Brothers.
At that moment, the drawing-room clock showed 8:40.
Another 5 minutes, said Andrew Stewart.
The five colleagues looked at one another. It can be assumed that their hearts were beginning to beat a bit faster, because even for such experienced gamblers the amount of money at stake was considerable. But they didn't want any of this to show, because, following Samuel Fallentin's suggestion, they seated themselves around a card table.
I wouldn't give up my £4,000 share in the bet, said Andrew Stewart as he sat down, even if someone gave me £3,999 for it.
The hands on the clock were showing, at that moment, 8:42. The players had taken their cards, but all the time they kept staring at the clock. However sure they were of themselves, it can safely be said that they had never found the minutes so long.
8:43,
said Thomas Flanagan, cutting the pack that Gauthier Ralph put in front of him. Then there was a moment's silence. The huge drawing room of the Reform Club was quiet, but outside could be heard the noise of the crowd, and sometimes above that, high-pitched shouting. The clock pendulum marked the seconds with mathematical regularity. Each player could count the 60ths of a minute that he heard quite distinctly.
8:44,
said John Sullivan, in a tone of voice that accidentally betrayed his emotion. Only a minute to go, and the bet was won. Andrew Stewart and his colleagues had stopped playing. They had put aside their cards. They were counting the seconds. At the 40th second, there was nothing. At the 50th, still nothing. At the 55th, they heard what sounded like thunder outside, applause and hurrahs and even some swearing, which got louder and louder as it rolled unstoppably towards them. The card players got to their feet. At the 57th second, the drawing room door opened. Before the pendulum had struck the 60th second, Phileas Fogg appeared, escorted by a jubilant crowd that had forced its way into the club. And, in his calm voice, he said,
"Here I am, gentlemen."
Chapter 37, in which it is proved that Phileas Fogg has gained nothing from this journey around the world other than happiness.
Yes, it was Phileas Fogg in person.
It will be remembered that at 8:05 in the evening, about 25 hours since the travellers had got back to London, Passepartout had been told to inform Reverend Samuel Wilson about a certain wedding that was due to take place the very next day. So Passepartout had set off, absolutely delighted at the idea. He quickly went along to Reverend Samuel Wilson's house, but the clergyman had not yet got back. Passepartout decided to wait, which he did for a good 20 minutes at least. It was 8:35 before he was able to leave the clergyman's house, but what a state he was in by then. His hair was all over the place, he was without his hat, and running as no one had ever run before, knocking over passers-by, rushing along the pavement at breakneck speed. It took him 3 minutes to get back to the house in Savile Row, and he collapsed out of breath on the floor of Mr. Fogg's bedroom. He was unable to speak. "What's the matter?" asked Mr. Fogg.
"Master,"
stammered Passepartout.
"Wedding! Impossible!"
"Impossible?"
"Impossible! For tomorrow."
"Why?"
"Because tomorrow is Sunday."
"Monday," replied Mr. Fogg.
"No! Today! Saturday!"
"Saturday? Impossible!"
"Yes, yes, yes!"
exclaimed Passepartout.
"You are a day out. We arrived 24 hours early, but there were only 10 minutes left."
Passepartout had seized his master by the collar, and he was dragging him off with irresistible force. After being snatched away like this, and without having the time to think, Phileas Fogg left his room and his house, jumped into a cab, promised the driver £100, and, after running over 2 dogs and bumping into 5 carriages, reached the Reform Club. The clock was showing 8:45 when he appeared in the main drawing room. Phileas Fogg had completed his journey around the world in 80 days. Phileas Fogg had won his £20,000 bet. So, how could a man who was so precise and meticulous have been a day out in his calculations? How could he think, when he arrived in London, that it was Saturday evening of the 21st of December, when it was instead Friday, the 20th of December, only 79 days after he set out? The explanation of this mistake is very simple, and here it is. Without realizing it, Phileas Fogg had gained a day during his journey, simply because he had gone around the world from west to east, just as he would have lost a day if he had gone in the opposite direction from east to west. By travelling eastwards, Phileas Fogg had gone towards the sun, and therefore the days became shorter for him by 4 minutes, with every degree of longitude he crossed in that direction. As the Earth has a circumference of 360 degrees, these 360 degrees multiplied by 4 minutes give exactly 24 hours. That is, the day that he had gained without being aware of it. In other words, by going eastwards, Phileas Fogg had seen the sun cross the meridian 80 times, whereas his colleagues back in London had only seen it cross 79 times. This is why, on that very day, which was Saturday and not a Sunday, as Phileas Fogg thought, these gentlemen were waiting for him in the drawing room of the Reform Club. And this is what Passepartout's famous watch, which was still set on London time, would have told him if it had shown the days as well as the minutes and hours. Phileas Fogg had, therefore, won the £20,000. But as he had spent about £19,000 during his journey, the financial return wasn't very great. However, as has already been said, what had made this eccentric gentleman take on the bet was the challenge, not the money. What was more, he divided up the remaining £1,000 between the trusty Passepartout and the unfortunate Fix, towards whom he could feel no resentment. The only thing was that on a point of principle he held back from his servant the cost of the 1,920 hours of gas that Passepartout had been responsible for wasting. That same evening, Mr. Fogg, as impassive and phlegmatic as ever, said to Mrs. Ayuda, "Are you still prepared to marry me, madam?" "Mr. Fogg," replied Mrs. Ayuda, "I'm the one who should be asking this question. You were ruined, but now you're rich."
"I beg your pardon, madam, but this wealth belongs to you. If you hadn't thought of getting married, my servant wouldn't have gone to Reverend Samuel Wilson's, I wouldn't have been informed of my error, and—"
"Dear Mr. Fogg," said the young woman.
"Dear Ayuda," replied Phileas Fogg.
It will come as no surprise to learn that the wedding took place 48 hours later, and that Passepartout, looking magnificent, resplendent and dazzling, gave her away. After all, hadn't he been the one who rescued her, and wasn't this honour owing to him? Nevertheless, the following day at the crack of dawn, Passepartout was banging on his master's door. The door opened, and the impassive gentleman appeared. "What's the matter, Passepartout?"
"What's the matter, sir? It's something I've just discovered this minute."
"Which is?"
"That we could have gone around the world in only 79 days.
"Certainly," replied Mr. Fogg, "by not going across India. But if I hadn't gone across India, I wouldn't have rescued Mrs. Aouda, and she wouldn't now be my wife, and..." With that, Mr. Fogg quietly closed the door. And so Phileas Fogg had won his bet. He had completed this journey around the world in 80 days. To do so, he had used all possible means of transport: steamships, railways, carriages, yachts, commercial vessels, a sled, and an elephant. The eccentric gentleman had displayed throughout his outstanding qualities of composure and precision. But apart from this, what had he gained from all this travel? What had the journey brought him? Nothing, it could be said. Nothing, that is, except for a charming wife who, however unlikely it may seem, made him the happiest of men. In all truth, isn't this more than enough reward for going around the world? This is Jim Dale. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne. This program was directed by Brian Smith and produced by John Colucci. Executive producer, Brian Smith. Translation copyright 2004 by Michael Glencross. Production copyright 2004, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved. Hello, this is Jim Dale, narrator of the Harry Potter audiobook series. As you know, audiobooks are great entertainment and a wonderful way to enjoy a good book when your hands are busy. But have you ever considered audiobooks as being good for you? Most of us know from first-hand experience just how beneficial it is to read aloud to the children in our lives. Listening to stories helps children build vocabulary, improve their reading skills, and succeed more readily in school. Being read to is an important step on the road to becoming a good reader, and one of the best ways to ensure a lifelong love of literature and reading. But few of us have all the time we would like to read to the children in our lives. That's where audiobooks can help. Instead of letting a child turn on the television or pop in a video game, try pressing play and engaging them in a good book. Listening to an audiobook has the same educational value as it would if you were the one doing the reading, and they are great entertainment for the times when you're in the car or at home and you can't read to them. A wide range of books guaranteed to appeal to children of all ages, including most of your own childhood favorites, are available on cassette and CD at bookstores and libraries across the country. So, the next time you're considering what to listen to yourself, why not consider picking something up for the children in your life?
Hello, this is Tim Ditlow, the publisher of Listening Library. I hope you enjoyed listening to Jim Dale's performance of Around the World in 80 Days. I wanted to take a moment and let you know that this is a very special recording in the history of Listening Library. My father created this company in 1955, and Around the World in 80 Days was the first book he recorded. This new production commemorates the 50th anniversary of the birth of Listening Library. My father loved science fiction, and when he came up with the idea of starting a talking book company based on classic unabridged recordings, he immediately set out to record the works of Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, Ray Bradbury, Isaac Asimov, and other great authors of the genre. In 1955, there was a lot of buzz around the soon-to-be-released all-star film version of Around the World in 80 Days, and my father thought that a recording that tied into the movie would help garner attention for his new company. I also believe that my father was inspired by Jules Verne, who used his art to explore the possibilities brought forth by the technological innovations of his era. My father also loved technology. In fact, he helped CBS Laboratories develop the 16 RPM long-playing record, which was the format used for the early audiobooks he produced. And given his background as a high school teacher, the idea of being a pioneer in this new world of spoken word recordings was a perfect marriage of the literature he enjoyed and the sound technology that was being created at that time. If my father were around today, his imagination would be ignited by the proliferation of audiobooks, and he'd be thrilled to learn that people were digitally downloading recordings he made 50 years ago. It's also fun to imagine that had Around the World in 80 Days been published today, as it had been in 1872 as a newspaper serial, that our audiobook version, too, would have been released simultaneously so that readers and listeners could share in Phileas Fogg's adventures. I did want to mention Jules Verne's approach to the various cultures around the world. Verne wrote with the bias of his background, and he viewed other societies through that filter. His observations of other religious, ethnic, and political groups are unacceptable by today's standards. Verne was curious about other cultures, but he was vastly more interested in science and geography. Though the physical descriptions of the places visited abound, the exploration of the cultures that inhabit those regions are superficial. For although the world had been made considerably smaller by removing obstacles to travel, the barriers between cultures remain strong. Understanding and appreciation for other social structures would not advance until many more people had the opportunity for exposure through travel. Verne's opinions of other cultures show his naivete and lack of experience with these groups. Often, when faced with a gap in his knowledge, he would create a moment of farce or violence, such as the scene in the court in Calcutta or the attack upon the train in America, to provide what he considered some regional authenticity. All of the characters in Around the World in 80 Days are painted with a broad brush, and even the main characters are fairly two-dimensional, like cardboard cutouts. Phileas Fogg is a single-minded Englishman who shows little interest in anything but his own pursuits, but who can be moved by a high sense of honor and duty. Passepartout is a resourceful but bumbling French clown who is a manservant dedicated to his master. And yet, despite the predictability of their natures, each character had the ability to surprise the readers that eagerly awaited the next installment of their adventure. Such was the genius of Verne's imagination. It is difficult to contemplate, but perhaps 100 years from now, someone listening to a current novel might also wonder about our naivete and lack of understanding or appreciation of certain social structures. However, like many good stories, Around the World in 80 Days continues to strike a chord with those who accompany its characters in their global trek, and despite the advances in technology and transportation, the real story is one of the human spirit and ingenuity. In fact, you might even say the same is true of audiobooks, in that whether the future delivery mechanism is an MP3 disc, a flash card chip, or some device yet to be invented, the real joy is in listening to the spirit of a great story come alive through a talented narrator such as Jim Dale. And speaking of Jim Dale, here he is to say a few words about the importance of audiobooks and literacy. Thank you.